Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. And for all you listeners who are waiting for about a month since the last one of these, it's good to be back. Well, I guess it's good to be back. I've had certainly a lot of emails over the last months of people recommending books and all kinds of stuff. I'll get onto some of them in a minute. But yeah, this is pretty much the first review that I've done since sometime at the beginning of September was the last proper review I did, mainly because I was on holiday, otherwise known in America as vacation, in New York, and it was really good. I was there for just under 4 weeks, and then I had a work trip after that as well, and I was just generally doing so much stuff that I didn't have a lot of time to read, and because when I'm at home, I was doing stuff at home. I say at home in this apartment that I was renting a room in. But when I was at home, I wasn't doing a lot of reading. And then when I was out, I couldn't listen to audiobooks or do anything like that because I was cycling around New York. And cycling around New York is a lot different than cycling around Berlin, where I actually live. Because Berlin is made for cycling and New York is not made for cycling. So generally, I didn't have any earbuds in or anything like that because it was pretty much too dangerous. And I was doing so much that I didn't get to read very much or anything like that. However, when I was there, I did buy the book that I'm going to review today, which, again, I'll get onto a bit later. I bought it new as hardback and actually only got around to finally finishing it off on the flight back from New York to Europe. But then I went on a work trip. Didn't have a chance to do the podcast when I was there as well. And then when I got home, I've been away for pretty much 3 months, like all of July, most of August. I was home for like 6 days out the whole of August, spread throughout August. And then I was away all of September as well. So I was catching up on 3 months worth of office work, 3 months worth of doing stuff like working on juggling routines and practicing that I've not done for a long time. Catching up on 3 months worth of not seeing my friends in Berlin and all that kind of stuff. And then this past weekend, I had a visit by a new girlfriend, which is very exciting, but not really appropriate to be sharing all of that here. And so, yeah, not much time for podcasting, except, of course, when I was in New York, I actually managed to record, I think, 9 different episodes of podcasts, only one of them an episode of this podcast, of the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. I did 2 episodes of the SFF Audio Podcast. I did 2 other interviews for another podcast project I'm starting and another 3 interviews/discussions for another podcast, which I'll tell you about when they're released as well. So I managed to do quite a lot of stuff, except not a lot of actual book reviewing podcasting. So some books that I've actually have read. I read Mindswap, which I recorded a review of on the SFF Audio Podcast. I think that came out in the feed for this podcast, so maybe you've heard that already. I read I Am Not a Serial Killer by Dan Wells, and I really enjoyed it. It's not a science fiction book. It's not even a fantasy book. I guess it's got some fantasy elements. It's mainly a teenage book. Well, I say teenager book. What do you call that kind of thing? You know, young adult book about a sociopath. And there's horror elements in there as well, but it's definitely not the kind of thing that is it would fit on here, because if it's science fiction, it has to have science fictional elements, and if it's fantasy, I think I'd rather stick to sort of like the secondary world fantasies rather than just like normal human worlds but with some paranormal activity. I think there's more sort of on the line of horror and things. I'm not gonna I don't read very much of that stuff, and I don't do it. I also read The War of the Worlds again for some reason. Well, for a reason I'll get onto probably in future podcasts. And I've also read some photography books. So I have been reading, just not a lot of fiction stuff as well. So, quick bit of feedback after talking about that news. Hello back to everyone who says hello after listening to episode 66. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, listen to episode 66 and see. Also, congratulations to everyone who's actually managed to listen to every episode so far. I was just emailing backwards and forwards to someone who says, hey, I finally managed to catch up on all of your podcasts. And I thought, wait a second, I recognize this name. Didn't he he told me he was going to start that in July. And it actually turns out somebody has managed to listen to all of the podcasts in order since July. And he did that by listening to nothing else while he has been on his commute. And now that I've got up to, what's this, 108 episodes plus bonus episodes and other things in the feed, it works out to, it's over 3 days of me talking shit and spouting crap and doing these reviews. So good going if anyone's actually managed to listen to all of the episodes here, because I haven't done that. I've certainly not listened to everything. Well, I mean, maybe I haven't listened to everything I've said, because I guess sometimes I say stuff without listening to myself. Anyway, so another tiny bit of feedback. This is sort of general feedback here as well. Hello, all. authors, budding authors, newly published authors, self-published authors, first-time novelists and publishers. Generally, if you want to send me a book to review, you can do so, but I'm probably not going to read it for various reasons and stuff. You know, if you're being paid to promote your book, you know, it's nice that you're considering me and you want to send me free copies and stuff and things like that. Send them in. Don't ask questions. Just send me a book, and if I get it and review it, that's great. But chances are I don't want it. And I'm specifically addressing new authors and self-published authors and first-time novelists here. Sure, I've got like 2,000 people who listen to these podcasts. However, that if I give you a bad review, that's 2,000 people who probably don't want to read your book, and I want a bit of a buffer between you and other people. I don't think it's fair for me to review work which has been put out there without the buffer of a publisher. And also, if you're a publisher, don't send me stuff anyway, because I'd rather hear from others. So it's a bit of a catch-22 situation here. I'm not any kind of I'm not a publishing arm. You know, I'm not here to help market anything. I'm here to document my own reading and also to get to help other people with their reading and things. And I'm not here to review new books. If there's a new book that comes out, like the book that I did, I went and bought this brand new from a shop. It cost like $30, this Evolutionary Void. And I'm happy to do that. And that's the kind of thing that I'm going to do if there's a new book that comes out that I really want to read. The chances are, put it this way, look through these reviews. And if your author has written a book which I've given 4 stars to, send it to me for free, because I'll definitely read it and really, really appreciate it. However, other people who send me books, I either don't read them or I give them bad reviews. I know it's bad to say that, but I like that bit of a buffer between new authors, because like if I give someone a bad review, I'm not saying that I'm powerful, and if I give you a bad review, nobody's going to read the book or anything. But if I give a bad review, I'm giving it directly to you if you've directly given me this book. And I think that's an unfair position for everyone as well. No obligations, though. Anyway, so what am I getting onto? Oh, yes, this book. Let me get onto this review, because I've just talked for way too long. But hey, it's good to catch up with people, and I hope people don't mind that I've been away too long. I'm definitely going to get back into this podcasting more, because I'm not so busy in these coming months, I don't think. And also look out for my new podcast project, which I'll talk about, I'm sure, a bit more in the future. So here we go. The Evolutionary Void. Let me open up the front of this book. It's a very heavy book. Let's see if you can hear this. I hope you're not all deaf. That was me dropping this book on the table here. It's a very heavy book. $28, it says here at the beginning of the book. So I'm trying to find the list of previous books by... here we go. So it says here, by Peter F. Hamilton, and it talks and it says the list of books. What you've got to know, though, is this is not just the third book in a series. I've already reviewed the first two books in this trilogy. It's not just the first book, the third book in a trilogy. It's actually the last book in a much longer series. Starting off in this timeline is Misspent Youth, which you don't need to read before you read this, but it does explain a tiny little bit about of one piece of technology, but it's really not a far future space opera kind of book. It's a near future new technology and its impact on the near future world kind of book. Anyway, it really kicks off with Pandora's Star, and it may seem a bit strange that this is a trilogy. This is this is the Void trilogy, and then you get these other Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained. There's characters which are mentioned in this book which are last mentioned in Judas Unchained or Pandora's Star. So it's really difficult for me to even review this book, because it might spoil Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained, which is 5 books ago. So it's a bit tricky, but really, you've got to, I would say, start at Pandora's Star, then go Judas Unchained, then go the Dreaming Void, then go the Temporal Void, and then go the Evolutionary Void. So this is pretty much book 6 in a longer series, but the third book in this trilogy. And so just to cover a little bit about this story, but really, you should be going back, maybe go back and listen to the other reviews that I've done of the Dreaming Void and the Temple Void to get a bit more of a flavour of what this kind of is. But what it starts off is that at the end of Judas and Change, humanity has defeated quite a threatening threatening alien threat, a big alien threat by, you know, in lots of clever ways. There's a threat from outside and there's a threat from within. They manage to defeat the two threats in different ways. One is a very big struggle with sort of like super spaceships and weaponry, and the other one is a very much smaller struggle with sort of like a small group of people going against it, which is pretty cool. The Dreaming Void, though, is set 1,200 years later after the end of Judas Unchained. However, many of the same characters are back, and they're in a new world, and lots of things has changed. You know, the galaxy has changed quite a lot. Humanity is spread out. And also they've discovered that the center of our galaxy is being consumed by this great void. It's this big sort of energy force field kind of thing, and nobody's quite sure what it is, but it's sitting there, and every now and then it expands, and then it expands a bit more and expands, and as it expands it gobbles up matter, it gobbles up energy, it gobbles up space, and there's this ancient alien civilization which is pretty much dedicated to stopping or trying to solve the expansion of the void, and if they can't do that, by protecting other people in the void, and that's called the Rael. And they're actually mentioned in Pandora Star and Judas Unchained, but we actually find out their main function, or one of their main functions here in the Dreaming Void. What happens, though, is that sometime in the past, a human has managed to get inside the void, or a human starship, a colony ship, has managed to get inside the void. And once it's inside the void, the people inside can communicate with the people outside by dreams that go across this network of connected minds across human space. And you got this dreamer on the outside and Eddard, who's the dreamer on the inside of the void, and they communicate by sending dreams one way and the other. And so that's what it starts off. And this religion springs up around this dreamer, and they're going to go into the void. However, every time that something touches the void or goes into the void expands and gobbles up more stars, and the Rael don't want that. And also other civilizations and other alien races don't want that either. So at the beginning of the Dreaming Void, there's going to be this pilgrimage to the void. And I was wondering, why do they want to go to the void? What's so special about the void? As you found out, that question was answered at the end of the second book, would you believe it? The second massive 700-page chunky book there. But an alien fleet sets off to stop the humans. It's like, we're going to invade Earth unless you put a stop to this pilgrimage. So the entire two books is people trying to stop this invading fleet, and also to stop the pilgrimage going ahead. And also there's this second dreamer, so they're trying to find the second dreamer because they're the only person who could get the pilgrimage into the dream without the pilgrimage being destroyed. You know, so there's lots of different stuff going on. Now, that's what happens all the way up until the end of the Temple Void. And at the end of the Temple Void, I found out what makes Eddard so special and what the secret to the void is and why everybody wants to live there. And it's a really big power and it's really impressive, and I didn't really see it coming. But then, of course, looking back, it's one of those things that Peter F. Hamilton does. It's like, oh, that's why. And then you think, well, that was obvious. And you think, well, why didn't I think of it? But he really does hide his twists, and he hides his ideas, and he hides everything in plain sight right here in the text of the book. And as soon as something happened, you go, oh, of course, and it's really obvious, but then it never is obvious. And there's also, right at the very end, we discover that Earth has this thing called the Deterrence Fleet, and the Deterrence Fleet is going to be used to stop this alien invasion. They're like, we can deal with it, but if we do, we're going to expose our strongest piece on our chessboard here to our greatest enemies and things like that. And the humans never want to do that. They want to keep the Deterrence Fleet as something which is only a deterrence. As soon as they use it, they can, the other technologies, the other technologically advanced aliens and all these other sort of higher civilizations, alien civilizations around, can look at Earth and say, aha, now we know what it is and what's it gonna happen. So the beginning of this book, I didn't really have any big questions except one: what Eddard is going to do inside the void, because he's the dreamer inside the void, and also what the deterrence is. Now, literally, this book starts off, and not quite chapter one, let me see here, it goes, it's actually halfway through chapter one, this first chapter. Casimir, who is like the head of the Navy fleet of Earth, with this alien fleet coming in, they're like, okay, right, I'm gonna go and start up, I'm gonna go and command the Deterrence Fleet. And they're going, are you sure? He's like, yep, here we go. So he goes off on that, and suddenly he's transformed into this I don't want to give too much away, but it's so well written. It's right here at the beginning of the book, and he's transformed into the Deterrence Fleet, which is this massively godlike power. It's not that godlike, but, you know, so it is explained. It's very clever, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. I was like, well, why don't they just use this to solve all the problems? There's so many problems here. Why don't they just solve all of this? And also, another big thing that I was really scared about with this book, let me just explain this. This book starts off, and, you know, it lists the books that have come before it, but there's no previously in the Void trilogy and listing the characters and who they are and where they're coming from. So I thought, oh, fuck, maybe let's skip to the end of the book, and I was going to see if there's a glossary there of all the characters like they sometimes do at the end of these trilogies. Nothing there at all. And I thought, this is either going to be really, really annoying, or this is going to be really, really awesome. Because it's like, I think it was last January, so it's been over a year and a half since I read the last book in this series. And they're big books. They've got a massive cast of characters here. And I was looking at it and thinking, okay, here we go. And so I just jumped in, and thankfully, I didn't need to catch up that much. You know, it was there. Everything was there in the text and thankfully. But again, all of these characters, which I wasn't quite sure, there was this massive cast of characters, and I wasn't quite, I was a bit nervous about setting them up with them. However, right at the beginning of this book as well, just as the Deterrent Fleet comes out, suddenly, and I don't want to give away what happens because it is very surprising, and then, of course, at the same time, it's a very surprising twist, and at the same time, you could just go, oh yeah, of course, that's what they've been working to, that's what everyone's been working to all along, but you don't, somehow you don't see it. It's really strange. This obvious in hindsight thing happens, and suddenly we're left with just a very small group of humans against a new powerful enemy. And the Deterrence Fleet is no longer a factor, and all of these other things are no longer a factor. And suddenly what I really enjoyed at the end of Judas Unchained, which wasn't the big space battle kind of stuff, which was going off in space with what I really enjoyed was the much smaller group who were isolated from everything, and then they had to sort everything out, and they had to use their wits, and they had to use interesting tactics and interesting methods to defeat I don't want to give it away, but the enemy at the end of Judas Unchained. That's what I really enjoyed. And suddenly this whole book is down to that. You do get the big scale things going on too, but suddenly you're left with a very small, much or a far more reduced cast of characters than you had at the end of the second book in this series. And suddenly I was like, ah, right, now I know how I'm going to enjoy this book. And it really was, because you could just, like, okay, don't need to worry about this massive cast. We can just, suddenly everything focuses down. And all of the world building that was in these first two books, actually all of the world building which has been in all of the previous five books set in this same universe, that is now just what is at stake here. Everything there that we've read about, all these different characters, now we have to make sure that they don't all die by the end of it. You've got all these planets, you've got all these characters and everything going on, and now this small group of characters, it's on their heads, it's on their shoulders, and they've got to work out. And these are characters that we've spent many, many pages with, thousands and thousands of pages with over the previous five books, or yeah, say over the previous four books. And so that's an interesting way, and I was very impressed with that. And then, of course, we start playing out to the end, you know, all these different things. We've got all these big questions. How are they going to solve it? What is the void? What's going on here? You know, what's happening with this? And also there's this, I think I forgot to mention this. Suddenly there's this another huge threat which comes in at the very beginning of this book, which has been a threat in the first two books, but suddenly they go, ah, this fleet coming in from the aliens, that wasn't the real threat all along. It was what was enabling the aliens to come in. And there was another threat there, which was very cleverly played in from the previous books, from Judas Unchained, the Judas Unchained book, which I thought, oh, that's clever as well. But it turns out that wasn't the threat, and the threat suddenly gets exponentially more dangerous and bigger as well. Again, it's because it's the threat from within. It always seems more potent than the threat from without, which I thought was really cool. Wow, I've been going along, and I'm trying, hopefully I'm not spoiling anything, but I'm saying what I like about science fiction, I like about epic science fiction. We play out this book, and everything in this book is relying on stuff which has come in the previous books. Now, normally what happens is, you know, you get to the third book of a trilogy, and And it's like the author has forgotten what happened in the first book, because to be honest, he didn't really expect the first book to become a trilogy. He just wrote a book and they're like, oh yeah, now in the second book we're going to make the story bigger. No, but here it literally the end of one book picks up again page two or page one of the next book, and then that book ends, and then this book picks up straight away again with no time has elapsed, nothing's happened, it's just go right here we go back into the story again. And it's so refreshing to read a solid trilogy of books where the ending was in mind, even though it took him 3, 4, 5 years to write this trilogy, the ending was in mind right at the very beginning. And this is actually came to me when I was first reading about the city of Macathran on the inside of the void, and they're talking about the size of the buildings and the shapes of the doorways and the steps and stuff, and I was like, and I was reading it, and I'd actually forgotten about this, but I was reading it, I was thinking, oh, wait a second, I know what's going on here. I know why the city is this size and shape, and I worked out now why the steps are different. And I worked that out by walking up a staircase in the Technical Museum in Berlin when I was there again. And by walking up that staircase and seeing the different different size steps as I was walking up, I worked out why the steps in Macathran are the way they are. It's not a big reveal if I've somehow given it away and people go, oh yeah, that's right. But anyway, I remember working that out in the last book, and I'd forgotten about it because, like I said, it's been over a year and a half. And then I read it in this book and was like, oh yeah. So it's always nice to find out these little touches that are sprinkled all the way through. Are really crucial. They're not just sprinkled nice touches all the way through the book. They're actually crucial to the plot all the way through. And even there's things that happen in the previous books in Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained, and character decisions that are made back then, and characters that you think are incidental or just smaller characters then, suddenly they come back into this book. And they're really key, and they're really... I mean, I'm not quite sure if you managed to work out all of the story of this book throughout the Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained, but there's elements there which are reflected in it. It's so refreshing to have a world which is logically consistent, even though all the technology is completely magical and it's all over the place, but actually the characters are consistent, the motivations of the different alien races are consistent, the world is consistent, and it all plays in to a very satisfying storytelling experience, because you know that nothing is just, oh, we'll just fix this later on. No, it's not like, oh yeah, that's from book three, I don't need to worry about it yet. He really did have all of this plotted out so strongly beforehand, and that's what, you know, it's almost surprising to have that so obviously and so, you know, so recognisably in a book. Also, I really enjoyed that on the inside of the void, time travels slower than it does on the outside of the void, which is, it really reminded me of the movie that I saw earlier this year, Inception, where inside the dream, things go slower than the outside of the dream. That's exactly what happens here. The people in the void and who time travels a lot slower for them. So again, within this book, you can have what happens so well at the end of Inception is that you can have these different layers of action. Like when one person can be having in Inception, it was like one person was, you know, driving off a bridge, and from the time that he's driving off the bridge, from the like him crashing through the barriers and hitting the water underneath the bridge, The entire action sequence that happens two dreams further in takes place just in that time. So you keep cutting back to this thing. And that's what happens in this book to a lesser extent, not to sort of like the most blatant extent that it does in Inception. But here it is very good that suddenly you think, wow, everything has to happen in the next few days. And then they go into the void and you go, actually, no, they can take a few months to solve this problem. And it doesn't always take that long. But it is suddenly interesting that near the end of the book, you can sort of go, relax down a bit, knowing that there's some people inside the void whose subjectively it's going to take quite a long time for them to get where they want to go. I'm not giving away. They get inside the void at the end, and it's actually inside the void where the things happen, where the denouement happens, if you can call it that. So here's the big question. The ending of a Peter F. Hamilton book, and I've complained about this. Generally what he does, he turns people into gods, he gives them special powers, and they go bish, bash, bosh, and they sort everything out. Or there's a sudden introduction of big new technology, and they just go bish, bash, bosh, and they go, oh, and it's sorted out like that as well. Now, it's never really sort of like a deus ex machina. It's never just go, oh, right, we'll just introduce it. It's always set up. It's always like foreshadowed. There's always something there, but it's always like kind of not that interesting anymore when you've seen it done not just by Peter F. Hamilton, but by other people as well. Everyone gets into the mess and you're like, oh, what's coming up? And then how are they going to sort it out? And then someone just goes, oh, yeah, you know, if I just plug my fingers in here, I turn into a god. And now I'm going to, you know, do this, do that. And I don't want to spoil any of his books because it's always interesting what happens. And it's always interesting how the suddenly godlike being can sort out all the problems. Now, I was a bit nervous because at the end of the second book in this trilogy, the end of The Temple Void, we find out what Eddard's power is and why everybody wants to join him inside the void because he's suddenly that godlike power. And everyone's like, hey, I want that power as well. So I want to be inside the void to have that power. And that was one time it happened. And then also at the beginning of the book, when suddenly we go, oh, the Deterrence Fleet is almost godlike. Why don't... And then you suddenly go, oh, well, that's not going to help anyone. And we realize actually, suddenly being all godlike isn't actually that helpful in this situation. However, does it happen at the end of the book? It does, but I think this is actually quite clever because it's more of a comment on that kind of approach to problem solving. In this book very much is, I mean, if there is a theme in this book, which I'll get into later, but one of the themes is like, okay, so transcending, like a race transcending into godhood, is it a good thing? And I think that I'll get onto that more later, but that is the main theme of this book. So it, in some ways, it had to happen to be commented on because it was also being commented in the second book because the... Actually, fuck it. I'm just going to skip forward in my notes. I'm going to talk about the theme now. Normally, I go back a bit more here. So, in the first book of this trilogy, the main theme of it was power. And I mentioned this, I think, quite a bit in that first review that I did of The Dreaming Void. It's all about the power and the use of power. Now, the second book was very, very much about once you have power, it's about the responsible use of power, because it's reflected both in Eddard's story, the character inside the void, and what's happening on the outside of the void. It's suddenly, okay, the main quote is, sometimes you have to do wrong to do right, I think, and that quote is even mentioned in this book as well, as sort of like a passing phrase. So, but because that was just a passing phrase in this book, but it was a major theme in the last book, I knew that power wasn't the main theme, and also the responsible use of power, but now, in this book, it seemed to be very much the cost of power, and the cost of gaining more power compared to other people, and things like that. So, that, I think, is the main theme, but again, there was so much plot happening here and so much action that the theme seemed to be a lot more secondary in this book than it was in the first two books. However, I say, like, what I find impressive about Peter F. Hamilton's is he can talk very specifically and very strongly and say a lot about these main themes without it feeling too preachy. In fact, in the second book with Eddard, it did seem a bit too preachy because of like that, responsibility and power, and sometimes you've got to do wrong to do right and all that kind of stuff. It felt a bit preachy at times, whereas this book certainly goes back to that first, the theme of this first book, which was more, it's not now the responsibility of using power, it's more about the responsibility of having power and acquiring power and just being powerful and the detrimental effects that can have on other people less powerful, or even other people just as powerful as you. So it's a bit of a strange thing. That's the main theme. Of course, there is a lot of other stuff going on here. Now let me skip back in my notes to where was I? Oh yes, the ending. Very satisfying. However, like in all Peter F. Hamilton books, it is, I always enjoy the journey more than the destination. It always feels a bit rushed at the end. Next one, though. Oh, next note here. Yeah, there is a wider... Oh, no, I mentioned that as well. Yeah, in the previous books, we did get a bit more of a sense of the wider world, which seemed to be a little bit missing from this book. It's like, if you just read this book, it doesn't feel that big scale. Of course, the conflicts are large scale, but the actual human world and the alien worlds, it's sort of like, oh, we get away from Earth and we get away from planets in the center of Earth's influence, and we get away from the main alien planets as well, and the alien spaceships, and so it really does shrink down it shrinks down the focus, but widens out the conflict and widens out the consequence at the same time. But I think if you read these books not as they come out like I did, but rather all at the same time, I think you'd probably enjoy the plotting of this a lot better. I don't think I'm going to go back through and read all five books of this main series in order again, but I think if you did, you'd certainly get a lot more out of it, because the characters which come up in this book, say at the end of this book, which are mentioned like in only four chapters in the Judas Unchained book, and suddenly they're a main character here. You're like, oh, okay, yeah, I remember that character. I can't remember if I'm meant to care about them or what. You know, it's a bit strange. So I do think to get the most out of this, you probably should read them all within 6 months rather than all within about 5 years like I've done. Moving on to the characters, less character stuff in this book than there is in the first two. I'm not going to talk too much about this because these are characters that either you know them because you read the books or you don't know them because you don't know, so you don't really care about them. I like the delivery man, and Ozzy comes back for a bit, and Troublem, he sort of bumbles around a bit. Paula has less of a role in this. Again, these are just random names if you don't know the books anymore. The interesting part is that the smaller cast, the smaller characters are interesting, and then some people die. I'd actually rather more people died. It was a little bit too cozy at the end. Too many people survived. Not everyone survived, but too many people did survive. However, the way that they survived and what they got in the end, the prizes that they got at the end, I thought was quite clever. The character which annoyed me more in the last book, because too much in the last book I think happened inside the void. It was all about Eddard and his rise to power and his rise through the ranks in the city and doing more. Now, we get far, far, far less of that in this book, which made me enjoy it more, not because I didn't think the Eddard passages were good in the last book, except that I didn't see the point in all of the Eddard passages in the last book until the final chapter. And then I was like, well, now I know why I've been reading all of this. So it was frustrating getting through all the Eddard chapters in the last book, but now I know what Eddard's secret is, and then reading him in this, I thought it was actually very interesting. And again, I don't want to give it too much away, but if you read my book, my Minding Tomorrow book, which I still keep getting lots of emails about people who have read it and enjoy it, so check it out, lukebourge.com/fiction.html. You can find it there. Anyway, I do quite like the parallels that you could maybe draw between those two books, but hey, I don't want to draw too many comparisons between my 50,000 word novel and this 1,500 word epic Zelda. So less Eddard equals a good thing in my book. And also it was a bit weird that all these other characters within Eddard's storyline, suddenly they don't mean very much to Eddard anymore. I mean, they do mean it, but they're sort of dropping out, and it's very much a much more personal story. So there was like, was it Dimli and all these other guys that we seem to care about a lot in the second book? Suddenly, they're not really mentioned very much in this book at all. It's just Eddard, 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 which, again, for the purposes of the plot and the theme, is actually, you know, perfectly okay. But it seems a bit strange that we spent so much time with them in the second book, and now it's just like, right, okay, we sorted out this mystery over here. Now we're going to go back into the wider world and fill in all the mysteries there. So anyway, there you go. Moving on to science and technology. Now, there is no science in this book. It's all about the technology, and there's not really that much technology. It's all about the magic. You know, the whole, you know, sufficiently advanced technology, blah, 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 blah. So forget all of the stuff in the previous books. I just looked back through my notes of the first review that I did here of the Dreaming Void, and I thought it was very good about like the mind, like the gear motes and the house, which was a network, and all these different things, which I thought was really, really cool. All the stuff that happened on the planets, all about the stuff about commerce and all the wormhole technology and all this kind of stuff. It doesn't really matter so much in this book, because what we do here is we just turn up the dials. Well, we don't do it. Peter F. Hamilton just turns up the dials to 11, and he rocks out with the big guns, you know. Because in the first book you had like wormholes, and then they build a star drive which can go faster than light, and they're like, woo-hoo! And then in this book they have a hyperdrive, and then they have they don't have a hyperdrive, they have a super hyperdrive, and then, I don't know, really at the opening of this book, it says this, it goes, the ship had no name, it didn't even have a serial number or even a mark, it was the only one of its kind. What was it called? Oh yeah, it streaked through the substructure of space-time at 59 light-years an hour, the fastest anything built by humans had ever travelled, you know. And it goes through lots and lots of techno jargon about different things like this. It's got the extremely sophisticated ultra drive that powered it might have reached even greater speeds if a considerable fraction of its phenomenal energy hadn't been used for fluctuation suppression. So, like I say, it's not just the technology which has been turned up, it's also the jargon that's been turned up, you know. And that is literally the second paragraph of this book. So we start off at that level. We suddenly ramp it up to an even higher extent. It talks about the deterrence fleet. It talks about this new threat that comes in. Later on, it talks a bit more about how different civilizations take themselves up to the next level. How they transcend to the next level, you know, and all that kind of stuff, and the technology used there, and it's all just jargon stuff. So that's what I'm saying. There's no science here, but it is all technology. But they use it like the biggest things in Judas and Change. They have this quantum starbuster, and you fire it at a star and explodes a star and stuff, and they then channel that into a wormhole generator that's designed to move planet-sized objects from one place to the other. But instead, they use it to propel a tiny spaceship halfway across the galaxy to jump ahead of someone who's using an ultra drive, and you're like, ta-da! And you're like, wow, this was the main thing in one of the previous books. This is the height of technology in a previous book, and now you've just used it to win a race. Effectively, and again, I'm spoiling it a little bit in that way, but it happens time and time again. The ultra weapons, the ultra big busting, planet busting weapons that were used as the final solution in Judas Unchained, so their big problems there. Here, they get two human spaceships which go head to head battles using more awesome stuff than that. So it's really high-level stuff. Well, not high-level stuff. It's really big stuff. It's really powerful stuff. I'll just take a drink. Thankfully, Hamilton can write this kind of stuff really well. When he writes action and battle, you're never confused as to who is who or where they are in relation to each other or what their motivations are or what level of technology that they have at their disposal or what they know or what they don't know and all these different kind of stuff. So what happens is that you know the entire situation at any one time, and so to get out of that situation, they have to be cleverer than I am, which in so many cases is them going, and now I'll do this. And you go, you'll do what? Oh, yeah. How? Why? What? Oh, yeah. And then you just realize, like I said before, you just realize Hamilton has been using the previous 400 pages of the book to set up exactly what he's just done there. And I'm just like, oh, man, how they are cleverer than I am. You know, even though Peter F. Hamilton's given you all of the information that you need. And if he doesn't do that, there's a bit of a deus ex machina. But again, he's set that up and foreshadowed it throughout the previous chapters. At one point in this book, suddenly these I won't give it away, but suddenly at one point they're like, dum-da-dum, and now I will kill you, and suddenly bum-ba-da-dum, and something rolls in to save the day, and you're like, well, that wasn't very satisfying, but however, it does make logical sense, because that was that thing that came in and saved them, that was their role, and they were waiting for that exact kind of thing, so it's a bit strange. Like I say, not so much new technology of human scale is introduced here, except for, like I say, the Terrence fleet at the beginning. Oh, there is a bit of... There's a cool thing that Ozzy has invented, but it's not really used very much in the main plot, but it is a cool thing, and then Ozzy, he turns up again, but then he runs away. The thing is, because it is so much jargon and because it is so much techno-babble and stuff, a lot of what the science and technology comes down to is, like I just said, in this opening page, they said... It just goes, using some kind... No, what is it? He goes, the extremely sophisticated ultra drive. And instead of... It's like the whole showing, not telling kind of thing. He just says, no, really, this kind of energy beam that they're using now is the most powerful energy beam so far. Because it resonates... it's like using some kind of resonating power beam, some fluctuating, quantumly fluctuating power beam. He shot this other thing. And you're like, right, I don't really know what that means because... Well, it's a bit strange, you know, if they'd just named it and then said it was at a higher power than anything has ever been before. However, the higher power than anything been before keeps on being topped by the next thing four chapters later. And now this is the new ultra super, it's not just the hyperdrive, it's now the ultra super hyperdrive with added quantum fluctuation suppression, distortion things, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So what he does, he just sort of combines a few of today's technology buzzwords and somehow manages to say, now that is what it is. But the thing is, I think the future of technology is beyond mere combinations of today's tech buzzwords, because even today's technology is beyond the combinations of today's tech buzzwords. You know, every time something comes out and someone says, oh, it's just a new Twitter. And you're like, but what's Twitter? And you go, oh, well, a Twitter is just a microblog. And you're like, well, what's a blog? It's like, well, a blog is where it's sort of like reverse chronological RSS feed aggregation, isn't it? You know, And you go, well, what's RSS for? And so every time that you say something, it has to be explained by in terms which you keep going back and back and back and back through the history of technology, and sometime you'll get to a point where everyone understands it, and you can get all the way back to, well, what's a computer? Well, a computer is this. Well, what's that? Well, it's a logic thing. Well, what's like, where it's got to be Turing complete and it has to run programs in RAM. It's like, well, what's that? And you get back to the point where you're going, look, Twitter is like writing on bits of paper and sending them to each other, like, really, really quickly, but you ask to be sent... You know, it's one of those strange things that it's really difficult to explain what future technology is like just by saying, using some kind of quill and a paper which magically copies itself across to the 300 followers Luke has on his podcast. And you go, oh, fuck, what's a podcast? Well, a podcast is like a town crier with a bell who rings the bell, but people don't have to listen to him when he speaks. They can listen to him later. And you're like, does that work? Hey, maybe he can do that. Maybe I should do this. Anyway, so what he's doing is he's explaining future technology using today's buzzwords in a way that I don't think is quite genuine. And I would prefer him just to either explain what it is just by saying, look, this was a really, really fast ship, and we called it the hyperdrive, and it traveled at 59 light years an hour. I'm like, great. And you could also say, and it also had a device which made it so it couldn't be tracked. I'm like, great. But instead, it's sort of like, it could have gone faster, but it used this dampening... To be honest, fuck it. I really like techno jargon, because if you've read the previous books, you know what all these things are. You know what the hyperdrives are. You know what the quantum busters are, and you know what the guillemots are, and you know all these different bits of jargon that he's been spreading throughout this book. Fuck it, it's great. It's really enjoyable. It just feels a bit. I don't know what it feels. It's fiction. Fuck it, who cares? I thought it was great. So, moving on. I've done the themes. What else am I going to do here? I've done action. I've done all this kind of stuff. Yeah, so conclusion. I might as well wrap it up. I've been talking for 40 minutes about this. Now, this book by itself, probably only worth, I say only, 4 stars, I'd say. It is very good. It's very well put together. I enjoyed it all. There wasn't a moment where I didn't know what was going on. And I thought it was amazing that even after not reading this book for, you know, 1.5 years, not reading the previous book for 1.5 years, and also the previous series or the previous duo of books, not knowing them, how he could just go, oh, and you remember this character from this book? And I'm just like, yes, I do. And it's so, like I say, it's so refreshing just to be able to read a book which has so much history, but then it actually relies on that history as well. So many books, they have this grand world and they have all this stuff going on and there's this whole amount of history. But because he has pretty much immortal people and people that can be brought back from the dead and technology which has ramifications across great times and distances and all these different aliens that fulfill different functions and different factions within the government or all these different things, he can just say, oh, you know this guy who you didn't know who he was all the time? He's actually this person. And you're like, oh, fuck yeah, of course he's that person. Now that makes sense that person, now that makes sense he's working against that. And that makes sense why the cat is trying to kill him. And that makes sense. And you just go, oh, great. And it's so, you know, it's so refreshing to see everything being pulled together like this. However, because it's been so long since I've read these other books, I can't give it more than 4 stars because there are parts where it relies on knowledge which is so almost arcane that it felt, like I say, it felt a little bit not contrived. I don't know how to say it. It felt like it was an experiment in extreme plotting and extreme world building combined with extreme techno jargon and extreme technology to such an extent. I mean, he pulls it off, and it's very clever what he's doing here. It is an amazing achievement. In the same way that I thought Anathem was an amazing achievement of sort of rebuilding the world from the plank length upwards and reimagining like a society which is based on, I can't remember the name of the philosopher that they had here, but it's based on Plato's philosophy rather than on later philosophies and how you can actually have a technological and almost post-technological world which is built up from that kind of philosophy and from it. So he rebuilt philosophy and science from the base level up again and still made an interesting story and made a compelling world, even though there was other flaws in that book as well, but it's very good. And I think that is actually what he's managed to do, Peter F. Hamilton's managed to do in this book. There isn't the same kind of rigor that Stevenson had in Anathem, but there is, the action is better and the characters are better and the pacing is better. Yeah, and also the cast of characters is quite amazing. However, I did think the characters were let down a little bit in this book. They seemed a bit like, oh, and now the end of the story will have a payoff for each of this character. This is this person's character payoff, and this is this person's character payoff, and this is it. And it felt a little bit too, I know, too forced in a way. And I really actually appreciated, say, Paula's character, who's been with throughout these series, right from the beginning of Pandora's Star. I actually quite liked it that she did manage to defeat an enemy in the end, but it wasn't sort of all wrapped up nice and neatly for her as it was for some of these other characters. However, the previous two books, I gave 4 stars, I think, to the first one and 3.5 stars to the second one, mainly because I got a bit sick of Eddard throughout that second book. But I said I'd always reserve final judgment and see how well the previous stories paid off, because it's difficult to just review such a first book in a series which didn't have an ending. And in the second book, again, it didn't really have a set ending. Unlike quite a lot of series where each book is a self-contained book, these really are not self-contained stories. It was very much one story. And I really did enjoy it. So big thumbs up. I think overall I'm going to give 4.5 stars to the Void trilogy. However, only, well, let me put it this way. Pandora's Star, Judas Unchained, and the Void trilogy together, I would give a solid 4 stars, 4.5 stars as a combined work. As a combined work, it really does stand up very begin. The end, like I said, is there from the beginning. The Rael mentioned in Pandora's Star are finally explained here, and the worlds we created. You know, like I said at the beginning, you could first think, oh, it's just some standard science fiction space opera future. It turned out to be far more involved and more complex, and the complexity mattered, and the history mattered, and it was logical. Despite all the godlike abilities of some of the powers and the technology all over the place, everything mattered and was logical in a way. In a way that, like I say, most books, when they get to book 6 in a series, the cracks are showing and they start sort of going, like, people always talk about how the Foundation series is just amazing. It's like, no, it wasn't. It was written as a short story, which was very popular. So he wrote another short story, which was also popular. So he combined them into a book, which was very popular. And then he wrote some more stories, and they were popular, and he put them together. And then you actually read the last book in the Foundation series, or whatever became the last book, and you're like, wait a second. So they just had to go, which end of the galaxy was the end of the galaxy again? I can't even remember the thing. But it's one of those things that as you go along, too many elements are introduced which break earlier rules, or the earlier rules don't apply anymore, or the characters don't matter so much because it's in the past. Whereas here, the characters stay consistent. Not that their characteristics stay consistent, but there's characters that stay throughout a massive stretch of history, which makes, like I say, it makes a big difference. Next up, though, okay, where does it go from here? Is there more books after The Evolution of Void? What I really want is a last chance of Eden for this series. Because at the end of the, which of the book? Let me flick to the front here. It was called the Night's Dawn trilogy. It had the Reality Dysfunction, the Neutrino Alchemist, and then the Naked God. Great series. I actually think this is a better series. I think there's more going on, more interesting things going on in this series, even though that is a very good series, very good sort of space opera series. Probably one of the better ones out there. Anyway, and then you got Second Chance at Eden, which was a short story collection with some novella length fiction in there as well, which tied up some of the loose ends and it told other stories set in that universe and was very interesting in its own right. And you can read that book, and doesn't spoil any of, I don't think it spoils that many of the main events in the Night's Dawn trilogy series. And also the Night's Dawn trilogy series doesn't spoil anything that happens in the Second Chance at Eden. What I want is that same kind of thing. I don't want another massive book 1,000 pages long, or a series which is like 2,000 pages long in total, set in this universe, set in this galaxy. I think there's enough happening in this galaxy that there's not enough mystery anymore for another whole series. But what I do think there is a mystery for, I mean, for example, there's the, who was the woman who Ozzy was with, and, you know, in this book, and there's other things that go, and it's like, they mention Nigel Sheldon, who went off in all these colony ships, because he says, hey, the galaxy is a dangerous place, and I'm going to go to the next galaxy with humans to make sure humans survive in the next galaxy, and everyone's like, yeah, go for it. And we don't hear from them again. And there's all these different little characters that, and events and aliens that are mentioned here, and these little, the little stories that are mentioned here. And you're like, oh, that would actually be really interesting. That would be really handy to know what happens there. I don't want another trilogy to tell me. I want a short story, collection, which is also, if written well, would be a good introduction to this world. Like, if Peter F. Hamilton writes it correctly, you could say, hey, someone could say, will I like the Void trilogy? And you'd say, well, you've really got to read these other two massive thick books first. Whereas what you could do is just say, hey, check out this little Last Chance, not at Eden, let's call it Last Chance at Macathran. Read that, and if you enjoy that, you'll probably enjoy this series. There you go. No spoilers in there. Hopefully, you've enjoyed this review. I think this is actually the first series of books, the first trilogy of books that I reviewed from the first book and all the way through to the end. And hopefully, my reviews have been entertaining enough and not too vague and not even spoilerific, not even for the first book in the series. So it's a bit of a challenge to do this, but I have just downloaded another book, which is the second book of the Book of the New Sun. I downloaded that as an audiobook, so I'm going to be listening to that probably next. Or at least within the next month or so. So I'm going to be continuing with another series. This is a lot more classic series by, is it Stephen R. Donaldson who... No, I'm getting completely mixed up. Let me quickly look at, make sure I've got this correct. Gene Wolfe. Why was I thinking Stephen R. Donaldson? Oh, that was the Gap series that I'm thinking, of course. Yeah, and I started that, and I have that. That's another series, which I read the first book in that series and do have the second book as well. That's why I was getting mixed up. So I've got the second book in the Gap series to read too, but I don't have any plans to read that straight away. I'm also started The Time Ships by Stephen Baxter, which is the follow-up to The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, which I started and quite enjoying quite a lot. I'll definitely take that on my next two-week trip away, which starts in a few hours' time. I'm leaving for my next two-week trip away after being home for a week and a half. Such is my life. And if you've got any other book suggestions, please send them to me. Lots of people have recommended over the years Slaughterhouse-Five, and they say that's really, really good book by Kurt Vonnegut. So I've also downloaded that to my podcast as well from Audible, so I'll be listening to that soon. Again, I don't know what order I'm going to get to these new books or what order they're going to come up in the reviews, but I do have a lot of books that I'm really looking forward to listening to or reading and reviewing here. Right, I've gone on long enough. What do I normally do at the end of this podcast? It's been far long. Yes, email me, luke@juggler.net, with any suggestions, any feedback. If you enjoyed this, if you've got anything to say about Peter F. Hamilton or about my reviewing style, if you want to know anything about my life or do anything like that, you can email me or follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge on Twitter. I post lots of things. Also, follow me and become my friend on goodreads.com, and that way I can see what you're doing. Search for Luke Burge. It's goodreads.com/Luke Burge. Also, there is a forum for SFBRP listeners there as well. So if you've got any questions, not just for me, but there's, how many people have I got following me now on here? I've got like 142 friends, and I think quite a lot of them will also get updates from the SFBRP listener group on goodreads.com. So that's something that you can check out too. Finally, if you want to find out anything about my travels, anything about my photography, anything about my writing of music, anything about my writing, or do anything like, check out my blog, which is lukeburge.com/blog. Lots of photography stuff on there, all my other projects which aren't just reading and reviewing science fiction, everything happens there on my blog. And also, if you're interested in reading my own fiction, I keep getting lots of very nice emails through people saying, hey, really nice book. And I think, actually, let me check on goodreads.com what the overall rating is of my book on goodreads.com. Let me check it out here. So it's not just me who thinks it's an awesome book, because, you know, I wrote it. My review, it says 5 stars, but I think if I click on it, I'll see the average review. I don't know why I'm doing this live during the podcast. Here we go. 4.12 stars out of 5 is the average rating for Minding Tomorrow. Let's have a look. So we've got 3 stars. Oh, these are friends who have read it. Thank you, Dan, for giving it 5 stars. And 396, give it 4 stars. Tamer, 4 stars. Thank you very much. Steve, 4 stars. John, whoever John is, rated it 5 stars. That's really nice. And also, people who aren't my friends also gave it quite quite high stars. So there you go. So check out my book. It's pretty good, and not just I think so. I thought I might as well plug that, because I'm not sure. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've done a podcast. I thought I might as well plug it. Anyway, 54 minutes I've been going with this podcast. So thanks a lot for listening, and I promise the next one will be along more briskly in a shorter amount of time than it has been between these last two podcasts. But thanks to everyone out there for listening and sticking with it. And if you enjoyed this, check out future podcasts too, or past podcasts. We'll see how it goes. I'll see you later.